The cultural upheaval of the 1960s has been analyzed to death over the years, served up as so much meaningless nostalgia in a hailstorm of articles, books, and Woodstock flashbacks. If you look back now at the scenes from 1967, from San Francisco's Summer of Love, it's easy to laugh at the be-ins, the flower power, the naive innocence that hippiedom seemed to represent. But what was going on in those few fragile years was something more significant than beads and flowers. It may have been the first place where the children of the baby boom realized just how much power they really had. They changed fashion, they changed politics, and certainly they changed the face of rock and roll. The influence of San Francisco-based bands was every bit as important to the late 60s as the British invasion had been to the early 60s. The San Francisco scene had as much to do with communal gatherings as it did the music, and the result was a loose, free-flowing musical style, the antithesis of three-minute pop songs. Perhaps that's why, even as Time magazine was chronicling this Haight-Ashbury culture, very few San Francisco bands were getting record deals. One of the first that did get signed was Jefferson Airplane. It was the Airplane's second album, Surrealistic Pillow, released in February 1967, that truly made America aware of the San Francisco sound. Rolling Stone magazine ranks Surrealistic Pillow at number 146 on its 500 greatest albums of all time. I asked Grace Slick, Marty Vallon, and Paul Kantner why the record companies had been so reluctant to sign those bands.
All you had to do was look at us.
and they looked in at the audience.
They scared people, you know, the long hair and the drugs, the
weird
beads,
outfits,
the flowers. They didn't know how to comprehend us.
It was totally strange people.
You know, we couldn't get served in restaurants. We couldn't get hotel rooms. We couldn't get a lot of things. We were always being watched by the police and talked about. In fact, you know, talk about Time magazine writing us up. I remember saying to Time magazine, gee, it's great that you're writing about all this wonderful thing that's happening here. And he looked me right in the eye and he said, you know, kid, it's the fastest way to kill it. And he was right.
She has an individual style. She's a part of a carnival time. Super steel lady, chrome colored clothes you wear, cause you have no other. But I suppose no one knows you're my plastic fantastic lover. Never shuts off, is nothing but a used machine. Her aluminum finish, slightly diminished, is the best I ever have seen. Cosmetic baby, plugged into me, and never ever find another. And I realize no one's wise to my plastic, fantastic lover. Electrical dust is starting to rust. Her trapezoid thermometer taste. All the red tape is mechanical rape of the TV program waste. Data control and IBM. Science is mankind's brother. But all I see is draining me on my plastic fantastic lover.
Yeah. It was Ballin, born Martin Gerald Buchwald in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1942, who put together the band that would become Jefferson Airplane. Marty had been a singer and dancer in musical comedies, and in 1965, he was running a folk music club in San Francisco called The Matrix. Marty Ballin told me how he first hooked up with Paul Kantner.
I was looking to put together a band to get some money to go to Europe, and I realized the quickest way I could make money in those days was every time I sang, somebody would pay me. So I decided to put a band together and make some money playing music. I had this idea that there was a new music coming around, and which everybody had. And I was looking for people, and I was at a hootenanny in a folk club, and Paul came in to play, and they didn't have any room for him, and I was at the door, and I told the doorman to give me my spot. I'd like to see this guy, because he had two guitars in his hand, which was rare. He had a 12 and a 6, and most people just had 6s or a 12. So he had two, and interesting-looking guy. And then he got up, and he took out his guitars and tuned them up and started to play, and he said, "Oh, I can't do this," and walked off, and I said, "That's the guy." And then I went backstage and introduced myself.
Ballin met lead guitarist Jorma Kaukonen in June 1965, just a few weeks after he and Paul Kantner started playing together.
We got together at Paul's house and went over some ideas and traded ideas to see if we could...
anything in common.
Yeah. And then walking down the stairs was Jorma and his wife, and I asked Paul who that was. He said, "Oh, that's Jorma, guitar player, teaching the guy upstairs." And I said, "Oh, we should get him for lead guitar." And he said, no, he's too good." And I said, "Well, we need somebody good. Let's ask him."
By July 65, the original band lineup was set. It included singer Signe Anderson and drummer Skip Spence. The last element was a bass player from Washington, D.C., named Jack Cassidy. Again, Marty Ballin.
Jorma had a friend who had played guitar with him, Jack Cassidy, who had gone to bass, and he kept telling us about it. So we took Jorma's word, and we started calling Jack up. We always called him like 2, 3 in the morning, so it'd be like 4 or 5 there, and we'd wake him up, and he'd always go and say, "Wait a second," and wash his face and hands and come back. And we told him, we were making a lot of money, and he had to come out. And we got him out of this college trip, and he came out and finally believed us. Of course, we weren't making a dime, but we did have a lot of fun. He came out and joined up with us, and that was our bass player.
Jefferson Airplane made their debut at the Matrix Club in August 1965 and quickly established a loyal following. Rhythm guitarist Paul Kantner remembers the Bay Area scene in those early days.
Also in the mix of the cauldron was the fact that LSD was legal in those days and was being passed around quite freely and breaking all sorts of doors down of what you were expected to do. Or what we expected of ourselves, even. And so people were extraordinarily open to pushing new directions in terms of, in our case, combining folk music and electronics and putting a club together around it rather than going and trying to audition for clubs.
Since there were no clubs to go to.
Yeah, there were no clubs.
So we had to build our own club.
I'm so full of love. I could burst apart and start to cry. Today, everything you want, I swear, it all will come true. Today, I realize how much I'm in love with you. With you standing here, I could tell the world what it means to love. To go on from here, I can't use words, they don't say enough.
Beautiful song Today from the Jefferson Airplane Surrealistic Pillow album. And here's the man who wrote it, Marty Balin.
It was just a chord pattern that I liked and was fooling with. And then I remember Tony Bennett was in the studio, so I wanted to write him a song. So I jokingly thought of how Tony Bennett would sing, and I sort of wrote the Tony Bennett kind of song. And he didn't want it. I couldn't even get near the guy. So so then we turned around and did it.
By the fall of 1965, the San Francisco music scene was evolving out of the folk clubs and into bigger venues, places like the Avalon and the Fillmore Ballrooms. One of the key figures was a promoter, a Russian immigrant who had changed his name to Bill Graham. He produced the Fillmore shows and for a while was Jefferson Airplane's manager. Singer Marty Balin remembers.
We were rehearsing at the Mime Troupe in their loft, and Bill Graham was their manager, secretary, business manager, I guess. And we had played a gig, we're a benefit for the Mime Troupe. And then after that, we were rehearsing there. And I remember going into the office and talking to him, because I had met him earlier before that in some play called Guys and Dolls. I was in the dancing course, and he came in to audition for Big Julie. And he was great, you know, he looked like a Big Julie. Then he started telling the director how he would do it. And this is like the smallest part in this whole play, you know. It's like he's on for about a minute. And he was telling the director how to direct the whole play suddenly, and it became a big fight, and she kicked him out, and they were yelling at each other. So I never forgot this guy. And then I saw him in there and at the Mime Troupe and then rehearsing in the loft, and I went in and talked to him. And I remember him asking us, or me, about, you know, what was going on. And I was telling him, you know, about the music scene, and I guess everybody else was telling him too. And so he began to work with us and put on concerts and listen to the musicians and put on people that people were talking about and wanted to see. And that's my first impression of working with Bill Graham.
Thank you. place that and your own. Lush paradise. They're very wise. Maybe they're disguised. Trying to revolutionize tomorrow. And I know.
She Has Funny Cars led off the Jefferson Airplane second album. When we return, we'll feed your head with the electric Kool-Aid acid test, one which everybody passes with flying colors. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Marty Balin, Grace Slick, and the late Paul Kantner on the 50th anniversary of Jefferson Airplane's Surrealistic Pillow.
Hi, this is Grace Slick from Jefferson Airplane. We're in the studio with Surrealistic Pillow.
And I'm Redbeard. Welcome back. Jefferson Airplane signed with RCA Records in November 1965 and released their first album a year later. The next one, Surrealistic Pillow, was released only 7 months after that. The first single from the album was a breezy sing-along called My Best Friend. Grace Slick and Paul Kantner believe the record company chose it because it was safer than most of the other songs.
They're businessmen. They're not necessarily artists, and they're trying to make money. And usually safe is the way to go. The people who make lots of money are not safe, but medium money people play it safe. And so they'll pull whatever on your record sounds like, oh, that sounds like the one that a month ago was number three. Or
yeah, they're like refrigerator salesmen.
Yeah.
They don't know why an Amana sells better than a GE, but they know that more people buy Amanas, so they stock Amanas. And if somebody comes in with a Studebaker refrigerator, they're not as likely to put it on the rack. And the same thing holds true for music generally, and TV.
Are you my best friend?
You are my best friend.
I love you so well.
To the
end of time, you won't see me. Are you my best friend?
You are my best friend.
I see you, it seems. Now I can see I've fallen into your love. Dream. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I'll follow you wherever time will take me to. Forever I'll be one with you.
One with you.
One with you. Hi, you're my best friend.
You are my best friend.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, what I mean now.
I didn't even like rock and roll, the 50s rock and roll. My girlfriends were all buying Elvis Presley, and I was listening to Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite, Rachmaninoff. I didn't like rock and roll. The only time I started liking it, actually, was when I heard Jack Cassidy's bass, which was different from most basses go thoom, 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 thoom. And Jack had this setting that was like a dinosaur having dinner or something. It was just unbelievable. Because of that, it kind of made the thing more like classical music in its grandness. Instead of doot, 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 which I consider to be kind of lightweight, it was boom, like that. The whole thing, structure of rock and roll to me, with these soaring, searing, big, monster sounds, made it very attractive. 50s rock and roll I didn't like, but 60s is different. Acid, or LSD, was originally manufactured by chemists, but used by the government in tests to see how they could disable people. And that originally, and I keep reading that over and over again, is how it started. The government was testing people at Harvard University. That's the Leary, Timothy Leary, and he calls himself Ram Dass. They were both professors there, and they used themselves as guinea pigs. But it was like chemical warfare in that they thought they could disable people, which
large
you can.
Large
I mean,
populations.
I don't know, any soldier who'd want to take 600 mics of acid and then try to fight. So you can disable them, but it turned out that it was not a chemical that was much usable by military. It doesn't have any military use.
And things got a little out of control. Experiment leaked out of the lab.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. And if you go chasing rabbits, and you know you're going to fall, tell them a hookah smoking caterpillar has given you the call. Call Alice when she was just small.
I enjoy doing White Rabbit, though, because it's so anachronistic. I take a certain perverse pleasure in the age of just saying no, saying feed your head. I mean, I'm not really pushing drugs at this point, obviously. It's just that it's the song itself is so out of sync with right now that it's amusing to sing it.
It's generalized enough also just to push frontiers, push to go where you haven't been.
Mm. Producer was Rick Gerard. He was pleasant insofar as he really didn't know what the hell we were doing, but he let us do it anyway. I think Johnny Walker helped him a little bit because he was confounded, but he let us do it, And we didn't spend much time on that record because I think we'd been playing it live. So it wasn't a matter of, they weren't...
About 2 weeks.
Yeah, they weren't new songs in the sense that we didn't just write them and come into the studio. We had played them before, with the exception of maybe two songs. So it went fairly fast, just sort of zipped right by the producer like lightning.
Still to come, one of the most important songs in rock's last half century. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio with Marty Balin, Grace Slick, and the late Paul Kantner on the 50th anniversary of Jefferson Airplane's Surrealistic Pillow.
Hi, I'm Marty Balin.
Hi, this is Grace Slick.
Hi, this is Paul Kantner from Jefferson Airplane, and you're in the studio with Surrealistic Pillow.
Thanks, gentlemen, and Ms. Slick. I'm Redbeard. This is the 50th anniversary of the album that Rolling Stone magazine ranks at number 146 on its 500 greatest albums of all time. Jefferson Airplane was by far the biggest commercial success among the early San Francisco bands. Still, they battled constantly with record company executives and top 40 radio programmers who were scared of their looks, their lifestyles, and their politics. Singer-songwriter Marty Balin finds himself often frustrated with the music business.
I sit there, sometimes I write a song, you know, and I see people walking by in the streets, and I just want to run out and play them my song, because what I have to go through to get that song to that same person walking by my window, I have to go through lawyers, I have to go through contracts, I have to go through record company, I have to go through producers, I have to fight like tooth and nail to get anything truthfully on the tape the way I wrote it, the way I want it to come out, the way I want it to sound, because everybody has control after I write the thing, that I just want to run out in the street and play it for the people walking by and say, it'll be a year before you ever hear this, and it may not sound anything like this, you know, so, you know, it's you take a lot on just to...
Yeah, it's a gauntlet.
When the truth is found to be lies, and all the joy within you dies, don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? Wouldn't you love somebody to love? You better find somebody to love. Love.
Song that Grace Slick had brought with her from the Great Society Band, That's Somebody to Love, from the Jefferson Airplane Surrealistic Pillow, released February 1st, 1967. If you were alive that summer and had a car radio, enough money to keep fresh 9-volt batteries in your little portable transistor radio, then Somebody to Love is seared into your memory, time-stamped and dated forever. In 1967, rock music was only beginning to emerge as a potent political force, and the members of Jefferson Airplane had to fight to keep the messages in their music. Here's singer-songwriter, rhythm guitarist, the late Paul Kantner.
I think you expect to fight. Not fight. I won't call the word fight. It's just there are obstacles that... I went to Catholic school, so rather than fight, I generally learned to try to go around and ignore whenever I can. And the record company was just something to go around. They didn't know quite what to make of us and weren't quite even sure why they signed us, other than that a bunch of people were writing about us and talking about us. Well, let's sign them. They might do something. But once we got in there, they suggested that we cut our hair and wear...
Checked our lyrics all the time.
Checked our lyrics.
Found things we had no idea was in the lyrics.
So we eventually started toying with them and giving them things to find to keep their attention away from the things we wanted them to ignore, which is what you do in Catholic school. So it was a good education for the record business on that level.
Part of the struggle centered on what the album would eventually sound like. The record company assigned a staff producer, but the band countered by bringing their friend Jerry Garcia from the Grateful Dead, who is credited on the album as, quote, musical and spiritual advisor. Here's Marty Balin and the late Paul Kantner of Jefferson Airplane.
We were playing in the same town together doing these... get together band things where we'd set up, they'd set up their punch bowls and put out acid
in
the acid test. And they were playing somewhere on Sunset. I think we did we play with them, or they just were in
town?
Well,
no, they were all friends of me and Yorma from college.
Yeah, they were friends, but they were in town in L.A.
And I think Garcia came down especially for this, too.
I thought they were playing.
To give us about a week. They were probably doing an acid test as well.
I remember going to the acid test. Down on Sunset.
Hollywood. Or Sunset, you're
Sunset,
right.
Sunset, down some
next
old building.
Next to that restaurant.
Yeah.
Where the Danny's, old... next to Danny's. The Danny's is still there. Right. I have it etched into my brain.
I remember that night.
Garcia was just... I mean, the bands were all close those days because we all weren't working as much as you do when you get later, you know what I mean? So we had time to hang out together and exchange musical ideas more, and we had some trouble with the record company on the first record and wanted sort of a buffer zone in there between us. And Garcia seemed like the perfect buffer zone that the record company, oddly enough, would go for.
The summer had inhaled and held its breath too long. The winter looked the same as if it never had gone. And through an open window where no curtain hung, I saw you. I saw you coming back to me. One begins to read between the pages of a look, the shape of sleepy music, and suddenly you're hooked. Through the rain upon the trees that kisses on the run, I saw you. I saw you coming back to me. You came to stay and live my way, scatter my love like leaves in the wind. You always say you won't go away, but I know what it always has been. It always has been a transparent dream beneath an occasional sigh. Most of the time I just let it go by. Now I wish it hadn't begun. I saw you. Yes, I saw you coming back to me. Strolling the hills, overlooking the shore, I realize I've been here before. The shadow in the mist could have been anyone. I saw you. I saw you coming back to me. All things like reasons are put in a jar. Whatever happened to wishes wished on a star? Was it just something that I made up for fun? I saw you. I saw you coming back to me.
That's the gorgeous Coming Back to Me from Surrealistic Pillow by Jefferson Airplane, written and sung by Marty Balin.
It was a song I had went home from the session that night and just sat down and wrote it in the hotel. And then I ran back to the studio, and it was early in the morning hours, and very few people were there. Grace was there, Jack was there, Jerry Garcia was there, and a second engineer. So I just said, turn on the tape, and the four of us sat down and went through it once, and he taped it, and then that was it. And I said, good, that's it.
Boy, is that simple. I love that stuff.
I wish we could have done that all the time. That's the way to record, I think. That fresh, I love that.
Writing in the allmusic.com, Bruce Etter says, and I quote, "The second album by Jefferson Airplane, Surrealistic Pillow, was a groundbreaking piece of folk rock-based psychedelia, and it hit literally like a shot heard round the world, where the latter efforts from bands like the Grateful Dead and Quicksilver Messenger Service were initially not too much more than cult successes. Surrealistic Pillow by the Jefferson Airplane rode the pop charts for most of 1967, soaring into the rarefied top five region occupied by the likes of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, to which few American rock acts, apart from the Byrds, had been able to lay claim since 1964. The Jefferson Airplane never made a better album, and few artists from the era ever did." End quote. The passion and the innocence that the San Francisco music scene and psychedelia represented didn't last long. Just watch the DVD film Monterey Pop about the 1967 Monterey Pop Festival, at which the Jefferson Airplane appeared. Then watch the Airplane's performance in the Woodstock DVD from summer 1969, where the camera is transfixed on Grace Slick, even when she's not performing. Then contrast those two filmed events with the Jefferson Airplane at Altamont in December 1969 in the movie Gimme Shelter, and it's shocking to compare the three. The LSD gave way to heroin and cocaine. The idealism got trampled underfoot by marketing and hype. The late Paul Kantner gets the final thought.
Yeah, America always either absorbs or kills its radical weirdnesses. You'll either see them selling at Macy's or they're being executed at San Quentin, one or the other.
Title song to the Jefferson Airplane's 1969 album, Volunteers. The band was elected to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1996. Jefferson Airplane co-founder Paul Kantner died in January 2016, just a year shy of Surrealistic Pillow's 50th anniversary. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Grace Slick and Marty Balin, and God rest the soul of Paul Kantner. In the studio, written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2017, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet, theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter and online at inthestudio.net.